Diego, Pastor Comparé.
Tonight I wanted to talk to you a bit about the prophet Jeremiah. Two of the prophets in the Bible were of the regular priesthood, Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And other than that, when God needed a man to stand up and say, "Thus saith Yahweh," he had to go outside the professional priesthood to find him, as is so often the case to this day. His name, in Hebrew, Yirmiyah, Yahweh will arise. You'll note that all of the great prophets had either Yah, the shortened form of Yahweh, or El, the mighty God, as part of their names. He was the son of Hilkiah, who was high priest. You remember reading that at a time of apostasy, things had gotten in a bad way. The temple had been pretty much taken over by pagan apostate priests. But one of the, at most, two or three good kings that the kingdom of Judah ever had, almost its only one, Josiah, was on the throne. And the temple was a mess. It was full of rubbish. It was badly in need of repair. And Josiah gave orders that the revenues should be used for cleaning up and repairing the temple. So Hilkiah, the high priest, found, tradition has it, he found it in a wooden chest in the treasury part of the temple. He found a complete book of the law, the first five books of the Bible. I don't know whether he found scrolls of the prophets or not, but at least there was the law. Now, the fact that only in cleaning up the rubbish did they find this shows the moral and religious state of the temple, as well as its dilapidation. So he took this, and it was shown to King Josiah. Now, you remember, in giving the law, God said, "If you will do these things, you will be blessed in every way. You will have peace, prosperity, victory if you do have to have war, easy victory. You will have good health, long life, everything good. But if you violate my law, then you're going to have trouble. You will be at war with your neighbors, and you will have considerable trouble winning those wars. You will lose your prosperity. You will lose your good health. You're going to have trouble all the way down the line." Well, there comes a time, you know, if you ignore God's laws and you begin getting these penalties, when you look upon them, it's pretty much the normal thing. Now, today, there are an awful lot of people in poor health. Instead of wondering why, we just accept that as being part of the normal way we should expect it to be. We don't know how it could be otherwise unless we can take pounds of poisonous chemicals put out by the big Jewish drug industry. So they were that way then. They have their troubles, but how could it be otherwise? After all, the pagan nations had troubles too. Then, this was read to King Josiah, and he saw that the troubles they were in were exactly those that were prophesied if the laws of God were violated. And furthermore, the prophecy indicated it was going to keep getting worse and worse until they got back on the beam again. So, Josiah was appalled at the state the nation was in, and he gave orders to bring a halt to the apostasy. Now, scattered around all through Jerusalem and in every village around it there in Judah, every little village and every neighborhood in Jerusalem had some sort of a pagan shrine where they were worshiping one of the pagan gods. So Josiah cleaned those up in very short time, and he brought them back to the worship of the one true God. What most people don't seem to understand is that the laws of God are natural laws, just as much so as the law of gravitation. And they are all just as self-executing. If you jump out of an 8-story window, you don't violate the law of gravity. You obey it, you come down. But you do it the hard way and you pay the penalty for violating the law. If you rode down in the elevator, you'd be obeying it the easy way and getting the benefit. And it is true with all these other laws of God that they are self-enforcing. Now, I have seen examples of this. For example, the agricultural laws. You remember one of these was this. When you plant a fruit tree, the first 3 years, you must not allow any fruit to form on the tree at all. Pinch off every bud before it can develop into fruit. The fourth year, you may allow fruit to develop if you wish, but none for you. It's too early to get hoggish. If you allow any fruit to form, you must bring it all to the temple as an offering. Now, the fifth year and thereafter, you can have that crop. That's yours. But we're too hoggish to do it, and we lose. Some years ago, a friend of mine, who owned a little ranch up near Escondido, he and his next-door neighbor planted orange groves at the same time. Now, their lands were adjoining on the same side of the same hill. They had the same slope, the same exposure to the weather, the same soil, nothing but a wire fence separating them, and they were planted at the same time. I saw this at the time the fifth year's crop was forming on their trees. Now, from the time those orange trees were as big as fair-sized weeds, the neighbor had been eagerly coaxing all the fruit he could get off of it. His trees weren't very big. They had thin, spindly branches. They had a very modest crop of oranges forming on them, but under every one of these thin branches was a board prop holding it up so it wouldn't break under the weight of a few oranges. Now, my friend's trees looked as though they were fully twice as old as his neighbor's. They were much bigger, great, thick, strong branches, and the crop of oranges forming on them at that time was, far more than double what his neighbor had per tree. In other words, taking the first 5 years together, my friend was getting actually more crop in that one-fifth year than his neighbor had gotten in the 5 years put together. Furthermore, he had sound, healthy trees that were always going to give him that kind of a crop. Now, the Bible never argues with you why you should do these things. God tells you, do certain things and you will prosper. Don't do them and you're going to have trouble. Another one of these agricultural laws said that every seventh year you had to let your land lie fallow. Not just pour on a lot of chemical fertilizer. 6 years you could get your crop. The seventh year you had to let it alone, let it rest. And we'd been too greedy to do it. And the result was what we saw in the Dust Bowl conditions back around 1930, which is exactly what the Bible prophesied for violation of it. It said, your heaven shall be like grass, and your rain shall be powder and dust. And that's what it was. Now, there's another thing beyond that. You read the articles about what they call the hidden hunger. that we are raising crops on worn out soil, and the plants cannot extract from the soil what is no longer in it. And the food we get is not as good as it should be. And as the Bible said, you shall eat and you shall still be hungry. Now, why? The Bible didn't bother arguing with you, but today we know the reason. The plants have to extract minerals from the soil. And the only minerals they can get are those that are in water-soluble form. Now you take pure river bottom sand, quartz sand, it's all mineral. But you get some nice, clean, washed river bottom sand and plant a seed in that and water it with distilled water so you're not giving it the minerals from another source. Make it try to get minerals out of that sand and a plant will spring up and it'll be sickly and it will die because it can't get any mineral out of that quartz, which is all mineral. It's not water soluble. Now there live in the soil enormous numbers of bacteria, and as a byproduct of their existence they produce certain acids. And these acids corrode away the surface of the sand grains and break them down into water-soluble mineral compounds that the plants can take up. Now, for thousands of years, we bred our plants for heavy yield, and that means drawing heavily on the soil for food. Now, you start out with what you might call a bank account of soluble minerals in the soil, but you are taking out of it every year a lot more than the bacteria can replace that same year. And at the end of 6 years, you've overdrawn your bank account. Now let it alone. Don't plant anything. And give the bacteria a year in which to make a new deposit in your bank account in the soil. Then you start the next 6 years, and there's something for your plants to feed on. So all these natural laws, the agricultural laws, the dietary laws, the economic laws, all are natural laws. So Josiah saw that the troubles they had in all these fields were exactly what the Bible had predicted for violation of God's law. And he gave the country one of its few periods of good rule. He brought them back quickly to worship of the one true God and obedience to God's law. Now about 5 or 6 years prior to that time, the prophet Jeremiah had been called to his ministry. The priests began their service, their active service, at the age of 30. Up to that time, it was study. You remember, true to that, Jesus Christ did not begin his ministry until the age 30. Then they conducted their active work as priests serving in the temple until the age 50. After that, they retired from the ordinary temple duties and they became the teachers. They were teaching not only the new crop of young priests growing up, but they were to teach all the people the laws of God and how they should live in order to gain God's blessing. So this matter of the finding of the books of the law there, Jeremiah refers to that in Jeremiah 15 verse 16, where he says, "Thy words were found, and I did eat them. And thy word was unto me the joy and rejoicing of mine heart, for I am called by thy name, O Yahweh, God of hosts." Now, you run into there a common biblical expression. When he says, "Thy words were found and I did eat them," of course he doesn't mean he gnawed on some old dry parchment leather. But when you eat food, it is digested, it's carried by the blood into every cell of your body, and it becomes a part of you. And these words had been digested in his mind till they had become a part of his mind and soul. You remember that when Jesus Christ said to the Jews that unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part in me, they couldn't understand that at all. They never did know the Bible. All they ever knew was the Talmud. But he was using an expression that should have been quite familiar to them if they had paid any attention to the Scriptures. Well, Jeremiah 1, verses 5 and 6, God called him to be a prophet. God said, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee and ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." Then said I, "Ah, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child." Now, he meant merely by this he was not yet 30 and ready for the ordinary beginning of a conventional priesthood. Some of the greatest of the prophets have been that same way. They weren't rushing out to eagerly take upon themselves what they knew to be the tremendous responsibility of being a prophet. You remember when God called Moses. Moses said, "Oh, send somebody else. I'm not a good speaker." And he pretty near got himself in difficulties with God. But God finally said, "Well, all right, I'll let your brother Aaron do the talking for you, but you go out and do the job I want done." Now, Jeremiah was called to be a prophet in the year 623 B.C., and he prophesied for 40 years in Judah, in and around Jerusalem. And it's interesting to note, through Jeremiah, more than most of the prophets, God was trying to bring this kingdom of Jerusalem back to its senses so they could be saved. And 40 years was this probationary period they had. And at the end of that time came the final destruction of the city under Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the deportation of the people into the Babylonian captivity. Now, when they came back from Babylonian captivity with a lot of hangers-on with them and into a land still filled with the corrupt Canaanites, and they set up the ill-fated little kingdom for the disastrous future that Daniel had prophesied to complete the transgression, you note that from the crucifixion of Jesus Christ in the year 30 A.D., they had 40 years until the destruction of the city by the Romans under Titus and the dispersion of the people, some taken as slaves and the rest driven out. Now, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem the first time around 606 B.C. And by about 604 B.C., there was the first deportation of a portion of the people to Babylon. He took with him those who could be leaders in rebellion, feeling that with them gone, the rest of the people would probably live up to the treaty they had made to be a tributary kingdom subject to Babylon. The final conquest and deportation was about 585 B.C. So you can see Jeremiah's ministry began before the first conquest of Jerusalem and continued there until the final one in 585 B.C. Other prophets contemporary with him included Daniel, who was in Babylon. Daniel had been taken there in the first deportation. Likewise, Ezekiel, who was taken to Babylon in the first deportation. The prophet Habakkuk gave his prophecies in Judah in 626 B.C., making him substantially a contemporary of Jeremiah 3 years earlier. Zephaniah had prophesied in Judah in the year 630 A.D. And it is entirely possible, you might almost say probable, that Obadiah was also a contemporary. Now, if you look in your Bible and see the dating assigned to the book of Obadiah by Archbishop Usher, you'll see how completely erroneous it has to be. Usher gave him the dating of 887 B.C. But you read your book of Obadiah, and it is entirely a denunciation of the Edomites for having assisted in the Babylonian conquest and deportation of the people of Judah. And that didn't occur until, as I say, about 606-604 A.D. and finished 585 A.D. Now, he doesn't talk about it as giving a prophecy that this would come in the future. Obadiah is denouncing the Edomites for what they have already done. So the dating necessarily would put him as a contemporary of Jeremiah. Well, as everybody knew, the prophets were not popular people. Pretty near all of them were murdered. Now, the man who says, look, what you're doing is wrong. You're getting yourself into trouble, you're getting the nation into trouble, and the whole thing is going to be bad unless you straighten up and behave. That man is never popular. So Jeremiah, having known about many earlier prophets who were martyred, was not eager to rush into this at all. He knew what he'd be getting into. But when he said, I cannot speak for I am a child, God's reply was this: say not, I am a child, for thou shalt go to all that I shall send thee, and wherever I command thee thou shalt speak. Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with thee to deliver thee, saith Yahweh. Then Yahweh put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and said unto me, behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms. Now note what his assignment was: to root out and to pull down, and to destroy and to throw down, and to build and to plant. Now, the book of Jeremiah in the Bible only traces him into Egypt after the final Babylonian deportation of most of the people, when a few of the rebels ran away to Egypt and compelled Jeremiah to go along with them. What always arouses my indignation about the ordinary churchmen is their eagerness to proclaim that the God to whom they give lip service is a liar. Now, here, unmistakably and theoretically, they had read the Bible when they were in their theological seminary. God gave Jeremiah the job not only to pull down some of the existing nations and institutions, but he said also to build and to plant. And as far as the Bible traces in the book of Isaiah, he had not yet built or planted anything. So what do these seminary-taught ministers say? Jeremiah is the prophet of doom. He died in Egypt in exile. In other words, he never completed the thing that God said he was going to do. Well, I've told you on other occasions about the pretty clear evidence we have that Jeremiah, with the daughter of Zedekiah, the last king, Jeremiah left Egypt with her and took her to Ireland, where there was on the throne there a king of Judah lineage, so that the two halves those of the true Judah line, the Perez and the Zara line were united by that marriage. It's interesting to note that some years ago, a member of this San Diego congregation brought to my attention the fact that some member of her family had had the family genealogy run down and a book published on it. Now, the family member who had this done had never heard of the Anglo-Saxon Israel identity doctrine, and no doubt wouldn't have believed it if he had heard it. So it wasn't a matter of wishful thinking and telling the genealogist, come up with something to bolster my ideas. But the genealogist found that one of their ancestors had come to Ireland in the party with the prophet Jeremiah. And this particular ancestor's job, he was custodian of the stone which is in the coronation chair today in Westminster Abbey, the Stone of Scones. Well, the job of being a prophet was a dangerous and thankless and unpleasant one, and God didn't let him out of that, but he said this, "For behold, I have made thee this day a fortified city and an iron pillar and brazen walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, against the princes thereof, against the priests thereof, and against the people of the land. And they shall fight against thee, but they shall not prevail against thee, for I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to deliver thee." And incidentally, all those named, the kings, the princes, the priests, and the people, did fight against Jeremiah and even on occasion tried to kill him, but they never succeeded. Now, you will remember that there were actually 13 tribes of Israel, because one of the original 12, that of Joseph, had been subdivided into two, the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, when they got into the country, the land was divided up so that each of 12 tribes had its own territorial area where that tribe was concentrated together. But one of the original tribes, Levi, was not given any land of its own. They were assigned certain cities, but not farming areas. Their job was not to be farmers. The tribe of Levi made up the priesthood, and the priests in those days were not merely the ones who served at the altar in the temple. They were the whole civil service of the nation. They were the administrators, the teachers, the judges. So, while there were some cities where they were concentrated somewhat, there was supposed to be no village in the whole land that did not have its Levite there as a judge, an advisor, and administrator. Well, when the religion became corrupted and paganism revived in the land, a lot of these priests scattered throughout the land set up pagan shrines in their hometowns. And of course, as head of the shrine, why, they made a very comfortable income out of this. So they were very much in business for themselves as pagan priests. And naturally, when Hilkiah and Jeremiah induced King Josiah to break up this paganism, why, it didn't sit well with these apostate Levites who were heading their pagan shrines. Now, the hometown of Jeremiah was Anathoth, a little village about 2.5 miles northeast of Jerusalem. Though there is perhaps some reason to believe that his family also had land in another village, Libna, which was another of the towns assigned to the Levites. In 2 Kings 23, verses 4 to 13, we read about this reform. And the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the priests of the door,
to bring forth out of the temple of Yahweh all the vessels that were made for Baal and for the grove and for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron and carried the ashes of them unto Bethel. And he put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and in the places around Jerusalem. Also them that burned incense unto Baal, to the sun, and to the moon, and to the planets, and to all the host of heaven. And he brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense from Geba to Beersheba, and broke down the high places of the gates that were in the entering in of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were on a man's left hand at the gate of the city. Nevertheless, the priests of the high places came not up to the altar of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun at the entering in of the house of Yahweh, and burned the chariots of the sun with fire. And the altars that were on the top of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars which King Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of Yahweh, did the king beat down, and broke them down from thence, and cast the dust of them into the brook Kidron. Pagan altars within the courts of the temple. And the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had builded for Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Sidonians, and for Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, and for Milcom, the abomination of Ammon, them did the king defile. Well, Jeremiah found himself immediately unpopular, therefore, with these Levites who lived in his hometown of Anathoth. And they warned him, if you don't stop prophesying trouble for apostasy, we're going to kill you. Now the political leaders, the princes, were against him. First he condemned their dishonesty, tyranny, and idolatry. And for another thing, he had gone at least twice as far as the river Euphrates. And obviously he must have visited Babylon while he was there. Daniel was his friend and would have introduced him to Nebuchadnezzar, because Daniel stood high in the councils of Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah chapter 13 tells of his trips to, he doesn't mention Babylon, but he does mention to the river Euphrates. So this was about 602 B.C., between the two deportations. Also it records that in 596 B.C. he wrote a letter to the people who had been deported to Babylon. This is 29th chapter of Jeremiah, telling them, don't let any so-called prophets among you get your hopes raised that you're coming back right away. You're not. You will have to remain 70 years in Babylon before God lets you return. So settle down and try to make something of yourselves during that period. From this, of course, he was suspected of treason. They said he's conniving with Nebuchadnezzar for the overthrow of the kingdom of Jerusalem. Now the common people hated him because he condemned their idolatry. Now, biblical religion is austere. It doesn't have all the interesting fornication festivals of the pagan religions, which the people liked so well. And when he condemned them for turning to idolatry, which was strictly designed to meet the people's desires for lower standards, and they had no guilty conscience, when he condemned this, the whole people turned against him. Now, they had been worshiping, among other pagans, the Queen of Heaven. Now, the Queen of Heaven was the pagan goddess Ishtar. And when you trace back the origin of that, you find that Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod, was extremely wicked, but extremely able. Nimrod had led the people of Babylon into every kind of wickedness and pagan idolatry. And when he was killed, instead of letting everything fall apart, Semiramis took over with a firm hand and kept the kingdom going. And she said that Nimrod had died for the people, was their savior, and he was now to be worshipped as a god in heaven. The next child that she bore, whose we don't know, she said this was the reincarnation of Nimrod. Now, as the wife of Nimrod, the god, she was queen of heaven. As the mother of the reincarnated Nimrod, she was the mother of God. In other words, those are the Catholic doctrines and where they come from. And still, today, the Catholic Church worships the Queen of Heaven with their general congregation utterly ignorant of where their priesthood got the doctrines. Now, Jeremiah was bitterly denouncing this paganism, and this was something quite popular with the people. After the final overthrow in 586 B.C. and the deportation, 585, he was still telling the people, this has come upon you because you're apostates to paganism. And they were saying, well, as long as we worship the Queen of Heaven, we had peace and prosperity. And now that we neglected this, as you told us, why, look what's happened to us. Jeremiah, the 44th chapter, tells of that. So, poor Jeremiah, he was running into trouble on every side. The princes were against him, and through them the king, Zedekiah, the highest praise you could give him was to say he was an unprincipled weakling. And when the princes put pressure on him to do evil, he went along with it. The priests and the people. In the 11th chapter of Jeremiah, he's running with astonishment into all this resistance. He says, but I was like a lamb or an ox that is brought to the slaughter. And I knew not that they had devised devices against me, saying, let us destroy the tree with the fruits thereof, and let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be no more remembered. So God says this, therefore, thus saith Yahweh, of the men of Anathoth that seek thy life, saying, prophesy not in the name of Yahweh, that thou die not by our hand. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will punish them. The young men shall die by the sword, their sons and their daughters shall die by famine, and there shall be no remnant of them. For I will bring calamity upon the men of Anathoth, even the year of their visitation. Well, all through this period, the kingdom of Judah, when it was first conquered by Babylon, had been reduced to a tributary kingdom. They had to pay a heavy tribute tax to Babylon and swear that they would be faithful to the Babylonian rulers. Well, naturally, that doesn't sit well with anybody. And the weakling king on the throne didn't like the idea that he wasn't an absolute monarch, able to do anything he wanted to. And he and his princes were conspiring with the king of Egypt. Now, the Pharaoh of Egypt didn't like Babylonian power right at his doorstep like that, naturally enough. So he was constantly conspiring with the kings of the little city-states in Palestine to revolt against Babylon and saying, I'll help you, I'll send the Egyptian army out to help you. Now, all this time, Jeremiah was giving warning. This conspiracy is going to fail. Egypt won't be of any use to you. You're going to bring upon yourself disaster. Now, Egypt, a couple of centuries before that, had been one of the great world empires. And why were they of no use now? During all the centuries, several thousand years, in fact, of Egypt's greatness, they were a pure white people. Their beautiful portrait sculptures show us that. In fact, while they were in Africa, they were not African in any Negroid sense at all. During all that period, any free Negro found in Egypt was summarily killed on sight. Nobody bothered to ask him, "What are you doing here?" because he couldn't possibly have any lawful business there. There were a few black slaves working in chains out in the field, but no free Negroes.